Look what I found. She studied it closely.
What is it?
It's more proof. At first, my father tried to show it only to Mom, but I managed to get a good look as he turned it over in his hands. A bird on one side, a man's profile on the other. United States of America, In God We Trust, Quarter Dollar, engraved on one side, and Liberty, and 1990, on the other. See? Evidence. He pressed it into her palm.
Where did you find this?
Mom asked. In the southern swamplands between the two war fronts. It's a genuine coin from 1990. See the name? United States. It was real. My mother's eyes gleamed with excitement, but she still gave Dad a grave look.
This is a dangerous thing to own, she whispered. We're not keeping this in our house.
My father nodded. But we can't destroy it. We have to safeguard it. For all we know, this might be the last coin of its kind in the world. He folded my mother's fingers over the coin. I'll make a metal casing for it, something that covers both sides. I'll weld it shut so the coin's secure inside.
What will we do with it?
Hide it somewhere. My father paused for a second, then looked at John and me. Best place might be somewhere obvious to everyone. Give it to one of the boys, maybe as a locket. People will think it's just a child's ornament. But if soldiers find it in the house in a raid, hidden under some floorboard, they'll know for sure that it's important. I stayed silent. Even at that age, I understood my father's concern. Our house had been searched on routine inspections by troops before, just like every other house on our street. If Dad hid it somewhere, they'd find it. Our father left early the next morning, before the sun even rose. We would see him only one more time after that. Then he never came home again. This memory flashes through my mind in an instant. I look up at June.
Thank you for finding this. I wonder if she can hear the sadness in my voice. Thank you for giving it back to me.
June. I can't stop thinking about Day. When I lie down in my apartment for a brief rest later in the afternoon, I dream of him. I dream that Day has his arms wrapped around me and is kissing me again and again, his hands running up my arms and through my hair and around my waist, his chest pressed against mine, his breath against my cheek and neck and ears. His long hair brushes against me, and his eyes drown me in their depths. When I wake up and find myself alone again, I can hardly breathe. His words run through my mind until I can't even understand them anymore. That someone else killed Mateus. That the Republic is intentionally spreading the plague in the poor sectors. I think back to how we were on the streets of Lake, when he would risk his safety because I needed to rest. Then today, wiping the tears from my cheek. I can't find the anger I used to have toward him. And if I discover proof that someone else killed Mateus, for whatever reason, then I have no reason to hate him at all. I'd once been fascinated by his legend, all the stories I'd heard before I met him. Now I can feel the same sense of fascination returning. I picture his face, so beautiful even after pain and torture and grief, his blue eyes bright and sincere. I'm ashamed to admit that I enjoyed my brief time with him in his prison cell. His voice can make me forget about all the details running through my mind, bringing with it emotions of desire or fear instead, sometimes even anger, but always triggering something that wasn't there before. 7:12 p.m. Tanegashi Sector, 78 degrees Fahrenheit. I heard you had a private conversation with Day this afternoon, Thomas says to me as we sit together eating bowls of edamame in a cafe. The cafe is the same one that we visited when Mateus was alive. Thomas's choice of location doesn't ease my thoughts. I can't forget the rifle grease smeared on the hilt of the knife that killed my brother. Maybe he's testing me. Maybe he knows what I suspect. I take a bite of pork so I don't have to answer. I'm glad that the two of us are sitting a good distance apart. Thomas had spent a great deal of effort convincing me to forgive him, to let him take me out to dinner. Why he did this, I can't be sure. To draw me out? To get me to say something by accident? To see if I would refuse and then take this information to Commander Jameson? It doesn't take much evidence to start an investigation against someone. Maybe this whole evening is just bait. But then again, maybe he's really trying to make up with me. I don't know, so I tread carefully. Thomas watches me eat.
What did you say to him?
There's jealousy in his voice. My words come out cool and detached. Don't bother, Thomas. I reach out and touch his arm to distract him. If a boy killed someone you loved, wouldn't you keep trying to figure out why he'd done it? I thought he might talk to me if the guards weren't around. But I've given up on him. I'll be happier when he's dead. Thomas relaxes a little, but he still studies my face.
Maybe you should stop seeing him,
he suggests after another long silence.
It doesn't seem to be helping you. I can ask Commander Jameson to send someone else to give Day his water rations. I hate to think of you having to interact so much with your brother's murderer.
I nod in agreement and take another bite of edamame. To stay silent now would look bad. What if I'm eating dinner with my brother's murderer? Logic. Caution and logic. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Thomas's hands. What if those are the hands that stab Mateus straight through the heart?
You're right, I say without missing a beat. I make myself sound grateful, thoughtful. I haven't gotten anything useful out of him yet.
He'll be dead soon, anyway.
Thomas shrugs. I'm glad you think so.
He drops 50 notes on our table as the waiter comes by.
Day is just a criminal on death row. His words shouldn't matter to a girl of your standing.
I take another bite before answering.
They don't, I reply. I might as well be talking to a dog.
But to myself, I think, Day's words will matter if he's telling the truth. Long after Thomas has escorted me back to my apartment and left, and long after midnight has passed, I sit awake at my computer and study Mateus's crime report. I've looked at the photos enough times now to keep myself from turning away, but it still leaves a queasy feeling in my stomach. Every photo is taken from an angle facing away from his wounds. The longer I stare at the black smears on the knife hilt, the more convinced I am that they're remnants of rifle grease. When I can't look at the photos any longer, I go back to the couch and sift through Mateus's journals again. If my brother had any other enemies, surely there'd be a clue somewhere in his writing. But he was no fool either. He never would have written down anything that could be used as evidence. I read through pages and pages of his old entries, all of them about irrelevant, mundane things. Sometimes he talks about us. These I have more trouble reading. One entry talks about the night of his induction ceremony into Commander Jameson's squad when I'd fallen ill. Another is about the celebration we had together when I scored a 1500 on my trial. We placed an order for ice cream and two whole chickens, and at one point in the evening, I even experimented with making a chicken and ice cream sandwich, which maybe wasn't the best idea I've ever had. I can still hear us laughing, still smell the warm aromas of baked chicken and fresh bread. I press my fists against my closed eyes and take a deep breath. What am I doing? I whisper to Ollie, who tilts his head at me from where he's lying on the couch. I'm befriending a criminal and pushing away people I've known my entire life.
Ollie looks back at me with that universal dog wisdom, then promptly goes back to sleep.
I stare at him for a while. Not long ago, Mateus would have dozed there, with his arm draped around Ollie's back. I wonder if Ollie's imagining that now. It takes me a moment to realize something. I open my eyes, then look back at the last page I'd read in Mateus's journal. I think I saw something. There. I narrow my eyes at the bottom of the page. A misspelled word. I frown.
That's odd, I say out loud.
The word is refrigerator, spelled with an extra D. R-E-F-R-I-D-G-E-R-A-T-O-R. Never in my life have I known Mateus to misspell anything. I study it for a second longer, shake my head, and decide to move on. I make a mental note of the page. 10 minutes later, I find another one. This time the word is elevation, but Mateus spells it E-L-E-V-A-T-I-E-N. Two misspelled words. My brother would never have done this by accident. I look around, as if there might be a surveillance camera in the room. Then, I lean toward the coffee table and start sifting through all the pages of Mateus's journals. I store the misspelled words in my head. No reason to write them down for someone else to find. I find a third word, bourgeoisie, spelled B-O-W-R-G-E-O-I-S-I-E. Then a fourth one, emanating, spelled E-M-A-M-A-T-I-N-G. My heart starts to pound. By the time I finish going through all 12 of Mateus's journals, I've uncovered 24 misspelled words. All of them come from the journals written in the last few months. I lean back on the couch, then close my eyes so I can picture the words in my mind. That many misspelled words from Mateus can be nothing other than a message to me, the one person who was most likely to go through his writing. A secret code. This must be why he'd pulled all the boxes out of the closet that fateful afternoon. This might be the important thing he wanted to talk about. I shift the words around, trying to form a sentence that makes sense, and when that fails, I move the letters around to see if each one might be an anagram for something. No, nothing. I rub my temples. Then I try something else. What if Mateus wanted me to put together the individual letters that are either missing from each word or in the word when they aren't supposed to be there? I quietly make a list of these letters in my head, starting with the D in refrigerator. D-L-W-G-W-U-N-O-W-M-J-W-U-T-C. E-E-L-O-F-O-O-M-B. I frown. It makes no sense. I scramble the letters over and over again in my head, trying to come up with various combinations of words. When I was little, Mateus played word games with me. He'd throw a bunch of letter blocks onto the table and ask me what words I could form with them. Now, I try playing this game again. I play it for a while before I stumble across a combination that makes me open my eyes. Junebug. Mateus's nickname for me. I swallow hard and try to stay calm. Slowly, I line up the leftover letters and try to form words with them. Combinations fly through my mind until one of them makes me pause. Follow me, Junebug. The only letters left after that are three W's, then C-T-O-O-M-D, which left one logical option, www.followmejunebug.com, a website. I run the letters through my mind several more times to make sure my assumption is correct. Then I glance at my computer. First, I type in Mateus's hack that allows me to access the internet. I put up the defenses and shells that my brother taught me. There are eyes everywhere online. Then, I disable my browser's history and type in the URL with trembling fingers. A white page pops up. Only one line of text appears at the top. Let me take your hand, and I will give you mine. I know exactly what Mateus wants me to do. Without hesitating, I reach a hand out and press it flat against my monitor. At first, nothing happens. Then I hear a click, see a faint light scan across my skin, and the white page disappears. In its place appears what looks like a blog, My breath catches in my throat. There are 6 brief entries here. I lean forward in my chair and start reading. What I see makes me dizzy with horror.
July 12. This is for June's eyes only. June, you can easily delete all the traces of this blog at any time by pressing your right palm against the screen and typing Control plus Shift plus S plus F. I have no other place to write this, so I'll write it here, for you. Yesterday was your 15th birthday. I wish you were older, though, because I can't quite bring myself to tell a 15-year-old girl what I found, especially when you should be celebrating. Today I found a photograph taken by our late father. It was the very last one in the very last photo album they owned, and I'd never noticed it before, because Dad had hidden it behind a larger photo. You know I flip through our parents' pictures all the time. I like reading their little notes. It feels like they can still talk to me. But this time, I noticed that the last photo in the album felt unusually thick. When I fiddled with it, the secret photo fell out. Dad had taken a photo of his workplace, the lab in Batala Hall. Dad never talked to us about his work, yet he'd taken this photo. It was blurry and oversaturated, but I could make out the shape of a young man on a gurney, pleading for his life, with a bright red biohazard sign imprinted on his hospital gown. Do you know what Dad wrote at the bottom of that photo? Resigning, April 6.
Our father had tried to resign the day before he and Mom were killed in a car wreck.
September 15. I've been trying to find clues for weeks. Still nothing. Who knew the deceased civilian's database was so difficult to hack? But I'm not giving up yet. There's something behind our parents' death, and I'm going to find out what it is. November 17. You asked me why I seemed so out of it today. June, if you're reading this, you probably remember this day, and now you'll know why. I've been hunting for clues ever since my last entry here. For the past few months, I've tried asking subtle questions of other lab workers and of Dad's old friends and searching online. Well, today I found something. Today I finally managed to hack the Los Angeles deceased civilians database. Most complicated thing I've ever done. I was going about it the wrong way. There's a security hole on their servers that I hadn't noticed before because they buried it behind all sorts of... Well, anyway, it resulted in me getting in. And much to my surprise, I actually found a report on our parents' car accident. Except it was not an accident. June, I'll never be able to say this to you out loud, so I desperately hope that you see it here. Commander Bakarin, another former student of Chan, you remember Chan, right? Submitted the report. The report said that Dr. Michael Iparis had roused the suspicions of the Batala Hall lab administrators when he first questioned the true purpose of his research. He'd always worked on understanding the plague viruses, of course, but he must have uncovered something that upset him enough to make him quietly file for a change in work assignment. Remember that, June? It was just a few weeks before the car crash. The rest of the report didn't go into the plagues, but it told me what I needed to know. June, the Batala Hall lab administrators ordered Commander Bakarin to keep an eye on our father. When Dad tried to get reassigned, Bakarin knew that he'd figured out the reason for his research. As you can imagine, this didn't go over very well. Commander Bakarin was ordered to find a way to smooth the whole matter over. The report ends by saying that the matter was resolved without military casualties, dated a day after the car accident. They killed them. November 18. They fixed the security hole on the server. I'll have to find another way around it. November 22. It turns out the deceased civilian's database has more information about the plagues than I guessed. Of course, I should have known that. What with the plagues killing off hundreds of people every year. But I always thought the plagues were spontaneous. They're not. Junebug, you need to know this. I don't know when you'll find these entries, but I know you'll find them eventually. Listen to me carefully. When you are finished reading, don't tell me you know about anything. I don't want you to do something rash, understand? Think about your safety first. You can find a way to help. I know you can. If anyone can, you can. But for my sake, don't do anything that'll draw attention to you. I'll kill myself if the Republic strikes you down for reacting to knowledge that I gave you. If you want to rebel, rebel from inside the system. That's much more powerful than rebelling outside the system. And if you choose to rebel, bring me with you. Dad found out that the Republic engineers the annual plagues. They start off in the most obvious place. Those high-rise terraces full of grazing animals isn't where most of our meat comes from. Did you know that? I should have guessed it. The Republic has thousands of underground factories for the animals. They're hundreds of feet deep. At first, Congress didn't know what to do with the crazy viruses that kept developing down there and killing off entire factories of animals. Inconvenient, right? But then they remembered the colonies war, and so every time an interesting new virus appears in the meat factories, the scientists take samples and craft them into viruses that can infect humans. Then they develop an equivalent vaccine and cure for it. And then they hand out mandatory vaccinations to everyone but a few slum sectors. Rumor has it that there's a new strain developing in Lake and Alta and Winter. They pump that virus into the slum sectors through a system of underground pipes, sometimes into the water supply, sometimes just directly into a few specific homes to see how it spreads. That starts off a new round of plague. When they think they've seen enough evidence for what that virus strain can do, they secretly prick everyone, everyone still alive, that is, in those sectors with the cure during a routine sweep, and the plague dies down until the next test strain. They also run individual plague experiments on some of the children who fail the trial. They don't go to labor camps, June. None of them do. They die. Do you see where I'm going with this? They use the plagues to cull the population of weak genes, the same way the trials pick out the strongest. But they're also creating viruses to use against the colonies. They've been using biological weapons against them for years. I don't give a damn what happens to the colonies, or exactly what our Republic wants to inflict on them. But June, our own people are lab rats. Dad worked in those labs, and when he tried to quit, they killed him. And Mom. They thought they would tell everybody. Who wants a mass riot? Certainly not Congress. We're all going to die like this, June, if someone doesn't step in. One of these days, a virus will get out of hand, and no vaccine or cure will be able to stop it. November 26. Thomas knows. He knows what I suspect, that I think the government may have killed our parents intentionally. I keep wondering how he knew that I'd hacked into the deceased civilian's database, and all I can think of is that I left a trace, and the tech guys who fixed that security hole found it and mentioned it to him. So he approached me earlier today and asked me about it. I told him I was still grieving over our parents' deaths, and got a little paranoid. Told him I didn't find anything. I said you knew nothing about it, that he shouldn't mention it to you. He said he'd keep it a secret. I think I can trust him. It's just a little nerve-wracking to have anyone know even the smallest bit about my suspicions. I mean, you know how he gets sometimes. I've made up my mind. By the end of the week, I'll tell Commander Jameson that I'm going to withdraw from her patrol. I'll complain about the hours and say that I don't see you enough. Something like that. I'll update here when I'm reassigned. I follow Mateus's instructions and delete every last trace of his blog. Then, I curl up on the couch and sleep until Thomas calls. I press a button on my phone and the voice of my brother's murderer fills my living room. Thomas, the soldier who would happily carry out any order from Commander Jameson, even if it's to kill a childhood friend. The soldier who used Day as a convenient scapegoat. June, he says. Are you all right? It's almost 10 and I haven't seen you. Commander Jameson wants to know where you are.
I'm not feeling well, I manage. I'm going to sleep a while longer.
Oh. A pause. What are your symptoms?
I'll be fine, I reply. Just dehydrated and feverish. I think I ate something bad last night at the cafe. Tell Commander Jameson I should feel a little better by evening.
Okay, then. Sorry to hear it. Feel better soon.
Another pause.
If you're still feeling sick by tonight, I'll file a report and send the plague patrol over to check you. You know, protocol. And if you need me to come over, just call me.
You're the last person I want to see. I'll let you know. Thanks. I hang up. My head hurts. Too many memories. Too many revelations. No wonder Commander Jameson had Mateus's body taken away so fast. I'd been stupid enough to think that she did it out of sympathy. No wonder she organized his funeral. Even my test mission to track Day must have been a diversion to distract me while they tossed out any remaining evidence. I think back to the evening when Mateus decided to resign from shadowing Chan and join the trial enforcers. He'd been quiet and withdrawn when he picked me up from school. "Are you all right?" I remember asking him. He didn't answer. He just took my hand in his and headed for the train station.
"Come on, June," he said. "Let's just go home."
When I looked at his gloves, I saw tiny specks of blood staining them. Mateus didn't touch his dinner or ask me how my day went, which annoyed me until I realized just how upset he was. Finally, right before bedtime, I went over to where he was laying on the couch and snuggled under his arm. He kissed my forehead. "I love you," I whispered, hoping to get something out of him. He turned to look at me. His eyes were so sad.
"June," he said, "I think I'm going to appeal for a different mentor tomorrow."
"You don't like Chan?" Mateus stayed silent for a while. Then he lowered his eyes as if ashamed.
"I shot someone at the trial stadium today."
This was what bothered him. I kept quiet and let him go on. Mateus ran a hand through his hair.
"I shot a girl. She'd failed her trial and tried to escape the stadium. Chan screamed at me to shoot her, and I listened."
Oh. I didn't know it back then, but now I can tell that Mateus felt like he had shot me when he killed that little girl. "I'm sorry," I whispered. Mateus stared off into the distance.
"Few people ever kill for the right reasons, June," he said after a long silence. "Most do it for the wrong reasons. I just hope you never have to be in either category."
The memory fades, and I'm left hanging on to the ghosts of his words. I don't move for the next few hours. When the Republic's pledge starts up outside, I can hear the people on the streets below chanting along, but I don't bother to stand. I don't salute when the Elector Primo's name comes up. Ollie sits next to me, staring, whining every now and then. I look back at him. I'm thinking, calculating. I have to do something. I think of Mateus, of my parents, then of Day's mother and his brothers. The plague has gotten its claws around all of us in one way or another. The plague murdered my parents. The plague infected Day's brother. It killed Mateus for uncovering the truth of it all. It took me from the people I love. And behind the plague is the Republic itself, the country I used to be proud of, the country that experiments on and kills children who fail the trial. Labor camps? We'd all been fooled. Had the Republic murdered relatives of my Drake classmates too? All those people who died in combat, or in accidents, or of illnesses? What else is secret? I rise, walk over to my computer, and pick up my glass of water. I stare blankly into it. Somehow, the sight of my fingers' disjointed reflections against the glass startles me, reminds me of Day's bloody hands, of Mateus's broken body. This antique glass was a gift, supposedly imported from the Republic's islands of South America. It's worth 2,150 notes. Someone could have bought a plague cure with the money spent on this glass that I used to drink water out of. Maybe the Republic doesn't even own these islands. Maybe nothing I've been taught is true. In a sudden fit of anger, I lift the glass and hurl it against the wall. It shatters into 1,000 glittering pieces. I stand there, unmoving, trembling. If Mateus and Day had met somewhere other than the hospital's back streets, would they have become allies? The sun changes position. Afternoon comes. I still don't move from where I stand. Finally, when the sunset bathes my apartment in orange and gold, I break out of my trance. I clean up the shining shards of broken glass. I dress in my full uniform. I make sure my hair is pulled back flawlessly, that my face is clean and calm and devoid of emotion. In the mirror, I look the same, but I am a different person inside. I am a prodigy who knows the truth, and I know exactly what I'm going to do. I am going to help Day escape.
Day. I try to break out of my prison tonight. This is how it happens. As night falls on the third to last day of my life, I hear more shouting and pandemonium coming from the monitors outside my cell. Plague patrols have completely sealed off the lake and Alta sectors. The steady rise and fall of gunfire coming from the screens tells me that the people living in those sectors must be facing off against the troops. Only one side has the advantage of guns. Guess who's winning? My thoughts wander back to June. I shake my head, amazed by how much I've allowed myself to open up to her. I wonder what she's doing right now, and what she's thinking about. Maybe she's thinking about me. I wish she were here. Somehow I always feel better with her. It's as if she can completely sympathize with my thoughts and help me channel them away, and I can always take comfort in her lovely face. Her face might give me courage, too. I've had trouble building up my courage without Tess or John or my mother. I've been thinking about this all day. If I can find a way out of this cell and arm myself with a soldier's weapons and vest, I have a fighting chance to get out of Batala Hall. I've seen the outside of this building several times now. The sides are not as slick as the central hospital was, and if I managed to break out of a window, I could run along one of the ledges wrapping around the side of the building, even with my healing leg. The soldiers won't be able to follow me. They'd have to shoot at me from the ground or the air. But I'm fast when I can find footholds, and I can tolerate the pain in my hands. I'll have to find some way to break John out, too. Eden probably isn't in Batala Hall anymore, but I remember quite clearly what June said to me on the first day of my capture. The prisoner is 6822. That must be John. And I'm going to find him. But first I have to figure out how to get out of this cell. I look over at the soldiers lined up against the wall and near the door. There are 4. Each wears a standard uniform. Black boots, black shirt with a single row of silver buttons, dark gray trousers, bulletproof vest, and a single silver armband. Each has a close-range rifle and an additional gun in his belt's holsters. My mind races. In a room like this with 4 steel walls that bullets could bounce off of, the rifles probably use something other than lead ammo. Rubber, perhaps, to stun me if needed. Even tranquilizers. But nothing that can kill me, or kill them. Nothing, that is, unless it's shot from a very close range. I clear my throat. The soldiers turn to me. I wait a few more seconds, then make a gagging sound and hunch over. I shake my head as if to clear my thoughts, then lean back against the wall and close my eyes. The soldiers seem alert now. One of them points his rifle at me. They stay silent. I keep up my act for another few minutes, gagging twice more as the soldiers continue to watch me. Then, without warning, I pretend to dry heave, then burst into a fit of coughs. The soldiers look at each other. For the first time, I see an uncertain light come into their eyes. "What's wrong?" one of them snaps at me. It's the one with a cocked rifle. I don't answer him. I pretend to concentrate too hard on holding back another heave. Another soldier glances at him. Maybe it's the plague. That's nonsense. The medics checked him already. The soldier shakes his head. He was exposed to his brothers. That young one's patient zero, isn't he? Maybe the medics didn't pick it up back then. Patient zero. I knew it. I gag again, trying to turn away from the guards as I do it, so they think I don't want their attention. I heave and spit on the floor. The guards hesitate. Finally, the one with the cocked rifle nods at the soldier standing next to him. Well, I don't want to stick around in here if it is some weird mutated plague. Call for a bio team. Let's have him brought to the medical ward cells. The other soldier nods, then raps on the door. I hear it unlock from the outside. A soldier from the hallway ushers him outside, then quickly relocks the door. The first soldier walks toward me. The rest of you, keep your rifles on him, he says over his shoulder. He holds out a pair of handcuffs. I pretend not to notice his approach, so busy am I with my gagging and coughing. Get up. He grabs one of my arms and pulls me roughly to my feet. I grunt in pain. He reaches up and unlocks one of my hands from its chain, then clips it into the handcuffs. I don't fight him. Then he unlocks the second hand. He gets ready to shove it into the handcuffs. Suddenly I twist, and for a split second I'm free. Before he can react, I whirl, yank the gun out of his holster, and point it straight at him. The other two guards fix their rifles on me, but they don't fire. They can't do it without hitting the first soldier. Tell your boys outside to open the door, I say to the soldier I'm holding hostage. He swallows hard. The other soldiers don't dare to blink. Open the door, he shouts. There's commotion in the hall, then a few clicks. The first soldier bares his teeth at me. There are dozens of them out there, he snaps. You'll never make it. I just wink at him. The instant the door opens a sliver, I grab the soldier's shirt and shove him against a wall. One of the others attempts to fire at me. I duck to the floor and roll. Shots are fired all around me. They sound like rubber pellets. I break out of my roll in time to trip a soldier flat on his back. Even this makes me grit my teeth in pain. Damn this sore leg. I dart right through the opening before they can close it. I take in the hallway scene in the blink of an eye. Soldiers litter the walkway. Ceiling tiles. Right angle turn at the end of the hall. The walls say fourth floor. The soldier who opened the door has started reacting. His hand goes to his gun as if in slow motion. I leap up, push off against one wall, and grip the top ledge of the door. My injured leg throws me off completely. I nearly fall back to the ground. More shots ring out. I swing up toward the ceiling and grab the crisscrossing metal between the tiles. Room 6822, sixth floor. I swing back down, kicking one of the soldiers in the head with my good leg. He goes down and I roll with him. I feel two rubber bullets hit him in the shoulder. He cries out. I crouch down and dart through the hall, dodging soldiers and guns, slipping out of the hands that reach for me. I have to get to John. If I can get him out, we can help each other escape. If I can... Then something heavy hits me across the face. My vision goes dark. I fight to concentrate, but I feel myself fall to the floor. I try to spring back to my feet, but someone knocks me down again, and a sharp pain makes my back twitch. A soldier must have hit me with the butt of a rifle. I feel hands pin my arms and legs down. My breath escapes me in a gasp. Everything happens so fast that I can barely register all of it. My head swims. I think I'm going to pass out. A familiar voice sounds out above me. It's Commander Jameson. What the hell is this? She continues to shout at her soldiers. My vision gradually comes back. I realize I'm still trying to fight my way out of the soldier's grasp. A hand grabs my chin. Suddenly, I'm looking directly into Commander Jameson's eyes. A foolish attempt, she says. She glances at Thomas, who salutes her. Thomas, take him back to his cell and put some qualified guards on his watch for once. She releases my chin and rubs her gloved hands together. I want the current guards dismissed and thrown off my patrol.
Yes, ma'am.
Thomas salutes again, then starts barking out orders. My free hand is clipped into the handcuffs that are still hanging off the other wrist. From the corner of my eye, I see another black-clad official standing next to Thomas. It's June. My heart leaps into my throat. She narrows her eyes at me. In her hand, I see the rifle she used to hit me. They drag me kicking and shouting back to my cell. June stands by as soldiers chain me to the wall again. Then, when they step back, she leans down near my face. "I would highly suggest you not try that again," she snaps. There's nothing but cold fury in her eyes. By the door, I see Commander Jameson smile. Thomas looks on with a serious face. Then June leans over again and whispers in my ear. "Don't try it again," she says, "because you won't be able to do it alone. You'll need my help." Of all the things I could have imagined coming out of her mouth, this is certainly not one of them. I try to keep my expression from changing, but my heart stops beating for a second. Help? June wants to help me? This is the girl who just knocked me to a state of half-consciousness in the hallway. Is she trying to throw me into a trap? Or does she really mean it? June pulls away from me the instant she utters the last word, as if she's just whispered something insulting. Commander Jameson lifts her chin. "Well done, Agent of Paris." June gives her a quick salute. "Follow Thomas down to the lobby, and I'll meet you there." June and the captain leave. I'm alone with Commander Jameson and a new rotation of soldiers standing near the cell's door. "Mr. Wing," she says to me after a while, "an impressive effort tonight. You are truly as agile as Agent Aparis claimed. I hate seeing such talents wasted on worthless criminals. But life isn't very fair, is it?" She smiles at me. "Poor boy. You truly believed you could break out of a military stronghold, didn't you?" Commander Jameson walks over to me, bends down, and rests her elbow on one knee. "Let me tell you a short story," she says. "Some years ago, we caught a young renegade who had a great deal in common with you. Bold and brash, stupidly defiant, just as inconvenient. He tried to escape before his execution date, too. Do you know what happened to him, Mr. Wing?" She reaches over, puts her hand on my forehead, and pushes me backward until my head presses against the wall. "That kid made it as far as the stairwell before we got him. When his execution date came, the court granted me permission to kill him personally instead of putting him in front of the firing squad." Her hand tightens on my forehead. "I think he would have preferred the firing squad."
"Someday you'll die in a worse way than he did," I snap back.
Commander Jameson lets out a laugh.
"Ill-tempered until the end, aren't you?"
She releases my head and tilts my chin up with a finger.
"What fun you are, my beautiful boy."
I narrow my eyes. Before she can stop me, I dart out of her grasp and sink my teeth deep into her hand. She shrieks. I bite down as hard as I can until I taste blood. Commander Jameson slams me into the wall. The hit knocks me loose. She clutches her hand, performing an agonized dance while I blink, fighting to stay awake. A couple of soldiers try to help her, but she shoves them away.
"I'm looking forward to your execution day," she snarls at me. Her hand oozes blood. "I'll be counting down the minutes."
And she storms away and slams the cell door behind her. I close my eyes and bury my head in my arms so that no one can see my face. Blood lingers on my tongue. I shudder at the metallic taste. I haven't had the nerve to think about my execution date. What does it feel like to stand in front of a firing squad with no way out? My thoughts wander around and then zoom in on what June whispered to me.
"You won't be able to do it alone. You'll need my help."
She must have discovered something. Who really killed her brother, or some other truth about the Republic? She has no reason to trick me now. I have nothing to lose, and she has nothing to gain. I wait for the realization to sink in. A Republic agent is going to help me escape. She'll help me save my brothers. I must be losing my mind.
June. I learned at Drake that the best way to travel unseen at night is by rooftop. I'm practically invisible at that height. The people on the ground keep their attention fixed on the street, and besides, up there I get the best view of where I'm headed. Tonight, I'm on my way back to the border of Lake and Alta, where I'd gotten into the skiz fight with Kayade. I need to find her now, before I have to return to Batala Hall in the morning and go over details of Day's botched escape with Commander Jameson. Kayade is going to be my best ally for Day's upcoming execution. Shortly after midnight, I get dressed all in black. Black hiking boots, a thin black aviator jacket, knives at my belt, a small backpack strapped to my shoulders. I don't bring my guns. I don't want anyone to track me to the plague sectors. I make my way to the top of my high-rise until I'm standing alone on the roof with the wind whistling all around me. I can smell the moisture in the air. A few terraces still have animals grazing at this hour. The sight of them makes me wonder whether I've been living over an underground meat factory all this time. From here, I can see all of downtown Los Angeles, as well as many of its surrounding sectors, and the thin rim of land that separates the enormous lake from the Pacific Ocean. It's easy to pick out where the wealthy sectors border the poorest ones, where the steady light from electricity gives way to flickering lanterns, bonfires, and steam power plants. I use an air rope launcher to connect a thin cable between two buildings. Then, I glide silently from high-rise to high-rise until I'm well out of the Batala and Ruby sectors. Here, the going gets a little trickier. The buildings aren't as tall, and the roofs are crumbling, some threatening to collapse entirely if too much force hits them. I choose targets carefully. A few times, I'm forced to aim the launcher lower than the roof, and then shimmy my way to the top once I get to that side. By the time I reach the outskirts of Lake Sector, I can feel sweat dripping down my neck and back. The lake's edge sits just a few blocks away. When I take a good look across the sector, I see that red tape lines almost every block, and plague patrol soldiers with gas masks and black capes stand at every street corner. X's mark rows and rows of doors. I see one patrol going from door to door, pretending to do another routine sweep. I have a hunch that they are doling out cures right now, just as Mateus said, and in a few more weeks, this plague will have magically trickled away. I make a point not to look anywhere close to where Day's house is, or perhaps was. As if his mother's body might still be lying there on the street. It takes me another 10 minutes to reach the place outside of Lake where I met Day. Here the rooftops are too fragile for my air rope launcher. I carefully inch my way down to the ground. I'm agile, but I'm not Day, and follow shadowed alleys to the lakefront. Wet sand crunches under my feet. I make my way through the back alleys, careful to avoid the streetlights, the street police, and the endless street crowd. Day once told me that he'd met Kayade in a bar here, at the edge of Alta and Winter. Now, I scan the area as I go. From the rooftops, I could already tell that there were about a dozen bars that matched the location and his description. Here on the ground, I count out 9 of them. Several times, I stop in an alley to gather my thoughts. If I'm caught here and anyone discovers what I'm doing, they'll probably kill me. No questions asked. The thought makes my heart quicken. But then, I remember my brother's words. It's enough to make my eyes sting, to make me clench my teeth. I've gone too far to turn back now. I wander through several bars without luck. They all look so similar. Dim lantern light, smoke and chaos, the occasional skiz fight happening in a dark corner. I check each fight, although I've learned my lesson about standing far enough away from the circles. I ask each bartender if he knows a girl with a vine tattoo. No, Kayade. About an hour passes. Then I find her. Actually, she finds me. I don't even get a chance to step inside the bar. I've barely walked out of an adjacent alley, and I'm heading towards this bar's side door, when I feel something fly right past my shoulder. A dagger. Instantly, I leap out of the way. My eyes dart up. Someone leaps down from the second floor, lunges for me, and knocks both of us into the shadows. My back slams into the wall. I reach instinctively for the knife at my belt before I see who my attacker is. "It's you," I say. The girl facing me looks furious. Streetlights reflect off her vine tattoo, and heavy black makeup outlines her eyes. "All right," Kayade says. "I know you're looking for me. You want to see me so badly that you've been wandering through Alta's bars for over an hour. What do you want? A rematch or something?" I'm about to respond when I see another movement in the shadows behind Kayade. I freeze. Someone else is here with us. When Kayade sees my eyes dart away, she raises her voice. "Stay back, Tess," she says. "You don't want to see this." "Tess?" I squint into the darkness. The figure standing there looks small enough, with a delicate frame and hair that seems to be tied back in a messy braid. Large, luminous eyes peer at me from behind Kayade. I find myself itching to break into a smile. I know this is news that will make Day very happy. Tess steps forward. She looks healthy enough, although dark circles have appeared under her eyes. The suspicious look on her face sends a wave of shame through me. "Hello?" she says. "How is Day? Is he okay?" I nod. "For the moment. I'm glad to see you're okay, too. What are you doing here?" She gives me a cautious smile, then glances nervously at Kayade. Kayade shoots her an angry look and presses me harder against the wall. "How about you answer that question first?" she snaps. Tess must have joined the Patriots. I drop my own knife to the ground, then I hold my empty hands out to both of them. "I'm here to negotiate with you." I meet her stare with calm eyes. "Kayade, I need your help. I need to talk to the Patriots." This catches her off guard. "What makes you think I'm a Patriot?" "I work for the Republic. We know a lot of things, some that might surprise you." Kayade narrows her eyes at me. "You don't need my help. You're lying," she says. "You're a Republic soldier, and you turn Day in. Why should we trust you?" I reach around, unzip my backpack, and pull out a thick wad of notes. Tess lets out a tiny gasp. "I want to give you this," I reply, handing the money to Kayade. "And there's more where that came from. But I need you to listen to me, and I don't have much time." Kayade flips through the bills with the hand on her good arm and tests one on the tip of her tongue. Her other arm is wrapped in a tight cast. Suddenly, I wonder if Tess was the one to bandage up that arm. The Patriots must find her useful. "I'm sorry about that, by the way," I say, gesturing at her arm. "I'm sure you understand why I did it. I still have the scar you gave me." Kayade lets out a dry laugh. "Whatever," she says. "At least we got ourselves another medic in the Patriots now." She pats her cast and winks at Tess. "Glad to hear it," I say, looking sideways at Tess. "Take good care of her. She's worth it." Kayade studies my face a little longer. Then she finally releases me and nods at my belt. "Drop your weapons." I don't argue. I pull four knives from my belt, hold them out slowly so she can see, then toss them to the alley floor. Kayade kicks them out of my range. "You have any tracking gear?" she says. "Any listening devices?" I let Kayade check both my ears and my mouth. "Nothing," I reply. "If I hear so much as one pair of footsteps heading our way," Kayade says, "I'll kill you right here. Understand?" I nod. Kayade hesitates, then lowers her arm and guides us deeper into the shadows of the alley. "No way I'm taking you to see any other Patriots," she says. "I don't trust you enough for that. You can talk to us too, and I'll see if it's worth passing along." I wonder how large an operation the Patriots are. Fair enough. I start telling Kayade and Tess about everything I've discovered. I begin with Mateus, and then his death. I tell her about my hunt for Day, and what happened when I turned him in. what Thomas had done to Matthias, but I don't mention to her why my parents died, or what Matthias had revealed about the plagues in his blog entries. I'm too ashamed to say it straight to the face of two people living in the poor sectors. So your brother's friend murdered him, huh? Kayade lets out a low whistle. For figuring out that the Republic killed your parents, and Day's been framed? Kayade's nonchalant tone annoys me, but I brush it aside. Yes. Yeah, that's a sad story. Tell me what the hell this has to do with the Patriots. I want to help Day escape before his execution, and I've heard that the Patriots have wanted to recruit him for a long time. You probably don't want to see him dead either. Maybe the Patriots and I can come to some sort of arrangement. The anger in Kayade's eyes has turned into skepticism. So, you want revenge for your brother's death or something? Gonna turn your back on the Republic for Day's sake? I want justice, and I want to free the boy who didn't kill my brother. Kayade grunts in disbelief. You're living a sweet life, you know? Tucked in a cozy apartment in some rich sector. You know, if the Republic finds out you've been talking to me, they'll put you in front of a firing squad, same as Day. The mention of Day standing before a firing squad sends chills down my spine. From the corner of my eye, I see Tess wince as well. I know, I reply. Are you going to help me? You're fond of Day, aren't you? Kayade says. I hope the darkness hides the rising color in my cheeks. That's irrelevant. She lets out a laugh. What a joke! Poor little rich girl's fallen in love with the Republic's most famous criminal. And it's even worse since you're the reason he's there in the first place, right? Stay calm. Are you going to help me? I ask again. Kayade shrugs. We've always wanted Day. He'd make a perfect runner for us, you know? But we're not in the business of doing good deeds. We're professionals. We have a long agenda, and it doesn't involve charity projects. Tess opens her mouth to protest, but Kayade motions for her to stay quiet. Day may be a popular figure out here on the streets, but he's still one guy. What's in it for us? Just the joy of getting him on board? The Patriots aren't going to risk a dozen lives just to free a single criminal. It's inefficient. Tess lets out a sigh. I exchange a look with her, and I can tell that this is something she's been trying in vain to convince Kayade to do ever since Day was arrested. This might even be the reason why Tess joined the Patriots in the first place, to beg them to save Day. I know. I take off my backpack and toss it to Kayade. She doesn't open it. That's why I brought this. There are 200,000 notes in there, minus what I handed you earlier. A decent fortune. It's my reward money for capturing Day, and it should be enough payment for your assistance. My voice lowers. I've also included an electro-bomb, level 3, worth 6,000 notes. It'll disable guns for 2 minutes in a half-mile radius. I'm sure you know how difficult it can be to get one on the black market. Kayade unzips the backpack and sorts through the